KOIN Portland, where it's 11 o'clock.
CBS News. President Ford heads back to California in a matter of hours, his first trip to that state since a woman tried to shoot him in San Francisco 5 weeks ago. This is Doug Poling reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The president will fly to Los Angeles on Wednesday to take part in a Republican fundraising affair. Thursday, the president goes back to San Francisco for a luncheon. In San Francisco on Tuesday, a plea of not guilty was entered on behalf of Sarah Jane Moore, the woman who allegedly fired a pistol at the president there on September 22nd. Trial date was set for December 15th. In Sacramento Tuesday, a federal judge refused to throw out his order directing President Ford to give a videotaped deposition for the Lynette Fromm trials. She's charged with attempting to kill the president. The White House says Mr. Ford will give the tape statement Wednesday or Thursday while he is in California. More news in a moment.
The French call it an apéritif. In America, it's the appetizer you drink. Either way, Dubonnet goes before.
Before, that's the time to say I'll have a glass of Dubonnet. Before a meal by day or night, Dubonnet is always right. Before, yeah, before. It's the time before for Dubonnet.
Dubonnet. It all started in France, of course. And whether you call it an aperitif or an appetizer, the proper time to enjoy its distinctive taste is before. Before lunch, before dinner at cocktail time, before whatever you've got cooking. It's a wine that's right for your appetite. Dubonnet Before. Made to make what comes after that much better.
Before, yeah, before. It's the time before for Dubonnet.
Product of USA, Dubonnet Company, New York, New York.
President Sadat of Egypt goes to New York Wednesday to continue his official visit to the United States. New York Mayor Abraham Beame will not greet him. Beame said there will be no official welcome for Sadat and referred to Egypt's backing of that UN resolution condemning Zionism. In Washington Tuesday night, Sadat hosted a dinner for President Ford. Mr. Ford told Sadat the United States was exploring every avenue to bring peace to the Middle East. President Ford made a slip of the tongue during his toast to Sadat. He asked his guest to join him in a toast to the President of Israel. Mr. Ford then said, "Excuse me, I mean Egypt." Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago has started to get involved in next year's presidential race. A report from Bob Crawford of Station WBBM Chicago.
Acting on orders from Chairman Daley, the executive committee of the mayor's powerful Democratic machine adopted with a resounding aye a resolution which Daley said puts the entire Democratic Party of Chicago on record behind Senator Adlai Stevenson as a presidential candidate. It was the first time in his 20 years as mayor and as a celebrated kingmaker in national party affairs that Daley had placed his personal clout and the muscle of his organization behind someone prior to the start of a national convention. Daley would not say why he had taken such an unprecedented step this early, but his longtime political lieutenants told newsmen the mayor is backing Stevenson as a favorite son in order to give himself and the big Illinois delegation he will lead to next year's convention more freedom to bargain. Bob Crawford for CBS News in Chicago.
In Montgomery, Alabama, the office of Governor George Wallace says on November 12th, Wallace will officially announce that he is a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. A federal grand jury in New York has handed down an 80-count indictment against a major land development company. AMREP Corporation and several of its officers are accused of bilking people out of more than $200 million in the sale of semi-arid land in a desert area outside Albuquerque, New Mexico. The land was marketed as Rio Rancho Estates. The company responded with a statement calling the indictment wholly unjustified. It said Rio Rancho has already established itself as New Mexico's fastest-growing community. An Army general involved in the unauthorized bombing of North Vietnam in 1972 has been promoted. Major General Alton Slay was confirmed by the Senate for the rank of lieutenant general, but the vote was a narrow 49-43. General Slay had testified that he was only following orders from his superiors. Now this.
Fort Martin, Little League coach. How do you spell relief?
When I get acid indigestion, I spell relief R-O-L-A-I-D-S, Rolaids.
Missy Smith, switchboard operator.
For gas, I spell relief R-O-L-A-I-D-S.
Rolaids spells relief. Each Rolaids consumes 47 times its weight in excess stomach acid. Captain Allen, helicopter pilot. How do you spell relief?
The heartburn, R-O-L-A-I-D-S.
Rolaids spells relief. Use only as directed. You may feel it's an embarrassing subject, but since one out of every three people suffers hemorrhoid symptoms at some time, you should know about Preparation H. Preparation H gives prompt, temporary relief from occasional pain and itch in many cases. But Preparation H does more, actually helps shrink swelling of hemorrhoidal tissues caused by inflammation. With so many having the problem, it's comforting to know that Preparation H helps shrink swelling of hemorrhoidal tissues. Ointment or suppositories, use only as directed.
The government of Venezuela announced Tuesday night that all foreign oil companies operating in that country have accepted Venezuela's offers of compensation for their nationalized assets. The companies, mostly American, will be paid a little over $1 billion for their Venezuelan holdings. This is Doug Poling, CBS News.
In 97 News, a November 17th trial date has been set for Carl Bowles, charged with first-degree murder and the deaths of an Oregon couple. Spokane County Superior Court Judge John Lally today set the date for Bowles, accused in the 1974 shooting deaths of Earl and Viola Hunter of Eugene. Bowles has pleaded innocent to those charges. Well, the Portland School Board wants to give the Portland Exposition and Recreation Commission a chance to prove its case. G looks like a C. The ER Commission wants a large chunk of school district property right across Broadway from the Memorial Coliseum, saying that's the perfect site for expanding the Coliseum facilities. The school district says the land is owned by the district, and unless the ER Commission can come up with something better, the school plans will move forward. But, so the school district doesn't look like bad guys, board member Robert Ridgely proposed agreement with the ER Commission's 90-day moratorium on the land.
We should explore every reasonable opportunity for accommodating the Exposition Recreation Commission. We do not think there is an alternate site that will be the equivalent in tax savings for the Portland taxpayers. But if there is, we certainly want to work with the Exposition Recreation Commission in their plans to develop a new Coliseum.
If something firm isn't developed in 90 days, Ridgely says school plans should continue. A committee of the State Board of Higher Education has recommended that students be allowed to see evaluations of faculty members and courses at state colleges and universities. The recommendation will be brought before the State Board at its meeting November 25th. The staff of Chancellor Roy Llewellyn recommended the committee keep the evaluation secret under provisions of a state statute passed by the 1975 legislature. The statute is to protect the personal record of higher education faculty members. The weather forecast for the Portland metro area: kind of wet. Periods of rain through Thursday with lows at night in the mid-40s. Highs both days in the mid-50s. South to southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour are expected. The chance of measurable rain is 90% tonight, 70% tomorrow, 80% tomorrow night. 48 degrees outside right now. And that's Radio 97 News. It's 11:08.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater presents... I'm E.G. Marshall. Many of you may not be familiar with the writings of William Austin, since his main claim to fame is that he was the forerunner of the famous Nathaniel Hawthorne. But it is as sad, in a way, as this haunting tale I bring you, that he should have been so overshadowed by his famous antecedent. For no more poignant and heartbreaking, while at the same time terrifying, story could be told than this: the American version of the Wandering Jew, condemned and outcast, and the small, shivering, fever-racked child with the sad brown eyes, innocently doomed to share his exile with him forever.
Archer, in his lightning flash, do you see?
My eyes are dazzled. What should I be seeing?
There, in the center of the cloud.
What?
An open carriage, drawn by a fierce black horse, and the child clinging in terror to the man. There he goes, the storm breathes.
Our mystery drama, The Storm Breeder, was especially adapted from the classic William Austin story for the Mystery Theater by Ian Martin, and stars Michael Tolan and Fred Gwynn. It is sponsored in part by Anheuser-Busch Incorporated, Brewers of Budweiser, and Buick Motor Division. I'll be back shortly
with Act One.
Isn't it nice to know you're free? To see the things you want to see. The touch to height you've yet to reach. To know you're all that you can be.
In the free spirit department, Buick's midsize 1976 Century has a lot going for it. Efficient size, lots of room, neat things like that. But Century offers bonuses. It's a Buick, remember, which says one heck of a lot about how nicely it takes care of you. And Century does something for the sake of efficiency that no other American midsize car does. It comes with a V6 engine, and a Buick V6 at that. Century, the spirit will move you.
Not too long ago, this was both the most loved and the most hated song in America. But as we began to overcome the problems this song symbolized, we realized there was still much more to overcome. Hard, concrete problems that only knowledge could resolve. Today, we stand closer than ever to the answers to these problems. Close, but not close enough. Give to the college of your choice now, so that our young people can make the difference between a bright tomorrow or maybe no tomorrow at all. That way, I'll bet we can overcome just about anything.
We can overcome someday.
A public service message of this station and the Advertising Council.
The strange, weird, unforgettable fragment of American history brought to you here, we are indebted, according to William Austin, to one Jonathan Dunwell of New York. Mr. Dunwell was a judge, and as such, a general officer of the court by profession, but by inclination, an antiquarian and a collector of American history. It is his manuscript we bring to life.
In the summer of 1820, business called me to Boston. I sailed in the packet to Providence, and when I arrived there, I learned that every seat in the stage was engaged. I was fortunate enough to find a seat with the driver. It being a pleasant night, and he quite intelligent, we were chatting pleasantly when all of a sudden the horses drew their ears on their necks flat as a hare's, and the whole business of Peter Rugg began. What's the matter with the horses?
Have you a surtout with you?
Well, I need no overcoat. My jacket is enough.
You'll need one soon. You see the horse's ears?
Well, matter of fact, yes. I was just about to ask why.
They see the storm breeder.
The who?
You'll find out, sir. Keep your eyes ahead.
I am. The road seems empty and the weather is lovely. Not a cloud in the sky.
Yeah, but you will see him soon. The weather that follows will blot out the sun.
Are you pulling my leg, driver?
I wish I were, Mr. Dunwell, sir. Here, sir. Wind this bracket about you.
But the sun is shining.
Listen to what I say. Protect yourself as much as you can.
Approaching us was a weather-beaten chair, once built for a chaise body drawn by a great black fiery horse, traveling at least at the speed of 12 miles an hour. Seated in it were a child and a man, who glanced at us as he passed in such dejection of spirit and hopelessness that my heart seemed to suspend beating momentarily. In the moment that he passed us, our horse's ears sprang forward and bent so that they nearly met. Who was that man?
Nobody knows.
And the child?
Nor her. Though both are familiar to me. I must have passed them more than 100 times on near as many routes.
Without ever exchanging a word?
Not a word. In the beginning, he used to stop and inquire the way to Boston, even when he was traveling directly away from the town. But since he never seemed to follow my directions, I have ceased communication with him.
So that was the reason for the strange, fixed look he turned on you.
It could be.
And now he's gone. Disappeared as if neither he nor that frail, shivering child had ever been. Does he never stop anywhere?
Never longer than to inquire the way to Boston.
I see no signs of this promised storm.
But look in the direction from which the man came. The storm follows him.
By gad, you're right. There is a little black cloud speck in the east, but not much more than the size of my hat.
That there's the seed storm. With luck, we may reach Polly's tavern before it strikes. But you mark my word, the wanderer and his child will go on through rain and thunder and lightning to Providence.
To the town we are coming from, you mean?
Yes, sir. I would guess the real Providence is as far out of his reach as the Boston. He never seems able to find either. Now wrap that saddle blanket about you, for here it comes.
Hey! Giddy up! Giddy up!
Mark you in his lightning flash. Do you see?
My eyes are dazzled. What do you mean?
Watch as he comes again. There! In the center of the cloud.
What?
Don't you see? An open carriage drawn by a black horse and the child clinging in terror to the man. Now look. Do you see?
I see nothing but the lightning and the boiling blackness of the cloud.
No matter, perhaps as well for you. Now hold fast. We go full out.
Hey! Giddy up! Move then! Move!
Within a few minutes, we had broached a rise, and sliding and slithering came down into the hollow to Polly's tavern. In spite of the summer weather, a steam of damp arose from our clothes and those of other travelers. And the whole common room seemed to be awash with discussion of the storm breeder, whom almost all of them seemed to have met on the road.
Ah, the name is Derwent of Boston, in the import-export trade.
Jonathan Dunwell, recently seated as judge in our circuit courts. Bound from New York to your fair city.
Well, sir, my pleasure and privilege to meet so distinguished a gentleman. I'm afraid your city is fast surpassing ours in credit and notoriety.
Not entirely, sir. I'm afraid a citizen of your city is the focus of all conversation tonight. The storm breeder. Did you chance on him?
No, as it happens, not today. But too many times.
Too many times?
I could wish to see neither that man nor his horse again. Well, they seem not to belong to this world.
Well, how's that? I saw them plain, father and daughter, passing us on the road.
Did you speak?
No.
I have seen him wet and weary many times before tonight. And no one who has ever once seen him can ever be deceived again as to his identity.
You know him by name?
Yes, sir. Peter Rugg.
Peter Rugg. But who is this mysterious man?
That is more than anyone can tell exactly, save that he is a famous traveler, though held in low esteem by all inholders, for he never stops to eat, drink, nor sleep.
But why does the man never stop anywhere? Long enough to speak to anyone, at least.
By those who know the most about him, say the least, it is asserted that sometimes heaven sets a mark on a man for judgment or for trial. I'm thinking of the one time Rugg spoke to me. I was in Connecticut at the time, on a winding road, my horse as weary as myself. It was toward dusk, and all of a sudden, from behind me, traveling at that reckless clip for those roads, a fiery black horse pulling an open chaise caught up to me from behind.
Will you tell me how far it is to Boston?
100 miles.
100? How can you say so? I was told last night it was but 50, and I have traveled all night.
Problem is, sir, you are traveling from Boston. You must turn back.
How can you tell me so? It is all turn back. Boston shifts with the wind. One man tells me it is to the east, the other west. Even the guideposts all point the wrong way.
I think perhaps you're tired, and your little girl, too. Why not stop and rest? You're wet and weary.
Yes, foul weather since I left home.
Stop then up ahead at the inn and refresh.
No, no, I cannot stop. You see what follows me? I must ever stay ahead of it. So I must reach home tonight. I pray you are mistaken in the distance to Boston.
I wish I were. May I make some bold as to inquire if you are Peter Rugg? I think we've met before.
My name is Rugg. I meet so many... I have lost my way. I am wet and weary. I would take it kindly if you would direct me to Boston.
Where do you live in Boston? On what street?
Why, Middle Street. Everyone knows the house, with the great shade maple, across from the cemetery.
When did you leave Boston?
I cannot tell precisely. It seems a considerable time.
What, sir? How did you and your child become so wet? It has not rained in these parts today.
The shower caught me back on the road a piece. It always catches me, unless I keep moving. Moving. Would you advise me to take the old road or the turnpike?
Why, the old road is over 120 miles. The turnpike, but 97.
You impose on me. It is wrong to trifle with a traveler. You know it is only some 40 miles from Newburyport to Boston.
But this is not Newburyport. This is Hartford.
Do not deceive me, sir. Is not this river I have been following, the Merrimack?
Oh, no, sir. You are just outside Hartford. And this river is the Connecticut.
Have the rivers changed their courses? Has the cities their places? Am I forever? But again the clouds are gathering and the storm is at my heels. God curses me for that fatal rope.
He would talk no longer. His impatient horse leaped off, his flanks rising like wings. And that's the last time I saw the ill-fated Mr. Rugg.
Amazing. But you say he gave his address as Middle Street.
That is correct, Mr. I should say Judge Dunwell.
The house with the great maple shade tree across from the cemetery.
So he said.
Do you know Boston well enough to locate him?
Oh, no, sir. And my business seldom carries me that way.
But mine does. I think for curiosity's sake, I must go to Peter Rugg's home and try to find out why it is so difficult to return to. 20 years, you said, you've been seeing him on the road.
Oh, all of that. And the last was the only time we spoke.
I should like to meet the man face to face, if for no other reason than to find a better fate for that little girl, long since turned woman. When I get to Boston, I shall make it my first order of business. Which is exactly what I did. It was not easy, for the maps were inaccurate, and there was more than one Middle Street. But finally, I found it. The great tree smothering the house so that it lay in a shadowy gloom. The paint was peeling, the windows cracked and cobweb-ridden. But the path to the door was cleared, and I was sure that someone or something still lived there. It was with a strange trepidation I walked through the weeds and lifted the heavy knocker. At last, with a deep breath, I let it fall. Then, in utter silence, bathed in the shadowed gloom, I waited to meet whatever waited behind that door.
The house abandoned by its master for countless years. Is it possible that any evidence of him has remained, or his family? Does some heartbroken woman still wait for that lost child, or even for the storm breeder himself? Who and what is Peter Rugg? Phantom, or reality, or legend? We shall have to await those answers with Judge Dunwell until I return shortly with Act Two.
Somebody still cares about quality. To the Budweiser people, that's a lot more than just words. It's a commitment to continue brewing Budweiser the way it's always been brewed. With care, with pride, without compromise. And it's a promise to everyone who enjoys great beer that there's one thing they'll always be able to count on. That one-of-a-kind Beechwood-aged Budweiser taste. A taste that speaks for itself. Loud and clear. Hear it talking?
And when you say Budweiser, you say you care enough to only want the king of beers.
When you say Budweiser, you say
Nurse St. Louis.
Hi, this is Carol Burnett. Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933 and made life miserable for people in Germany. And that's why the International Rescue Committee, the IRC, was formed. It began by helping refugees from Hitler's Germany and went on to help millions more in World War II. But its work didn't end there because war and oppression didn't end there. Remember the brave Hungarians who stood up to the Russians in 1956? Well, IRC helped many who escaped. And since then, IRC has come to the aid of thousands who have escaped from Cuba, China, East Germany, Russia, or wherever freedom is pretty much of a meaningless word. It also does its work in countries ravaged by war. But IRC needs money for food, clothing, and medical care, to reunite families, to find people jobs, and homes for children without homes. So please, help the people who help. Send your money to this address, International Rescue Committee, Box 16, Times Square Station, New York City, New York, 10036.
Judge Dunwell was never fated to have an answer to his knock on the door. For in the very moment that something old stirs and rustles within the house, outside it, the small noises are smothered by the arrival of the familiar black chaise and the snorting, prancing steed that draws it.
Whoa, Lightfoot! Whoa! Don't you recognize home at last?
At the sound of the arrival, instinctively I had withdrawn deeper in the shadows, finding perfect concealment behind a clump of overgrown rhododendra. Twilight was just upon us, as a confident and somehow younger man than I remembered Peter Rugg to be strode up the path, just in time for the door to open. The little girl sat timid and immobile on the seat of the carriage, as if knowing the hopelessness of it all. Somewhere, low thunder grumbled.
Mistress Rugg, your husband is sorry to have been delayed, but circumstances beyond... I beg your pardon, madam, but I am looking for Mistress Catherine Rugg.
Who? Who did you say?
My wife, madam. The Mistress Rugg.
Oh, Lord bless you, sir. She ain't here. Ain't been here or in this world for 50 years.
What do you mean?
I mean, she's dead and gone like all of hers. Dead and gone and buried and lost.
But that can't be. I'm tired and worn, but this... I know my own house. I live here.
Oh, no, you don't. Not now you don't, whoever you are. I can show you deed and title which says that it's mine.
It is true. It seems as though it might be on the wrong side of the street. I don't know. It's hard to... forgive me, madam. I'm confused. Everything seems misplaced. The streets changed. The people changed. The town changed. And what is strangest of all, Catherine Rugg has deserted her husband and child. Pray tell me, has John Foy come home from sea?
Who?
John Foy, my kinsman. He could give me some account of Mrs. Rugg.
I never heard of John Foy. Where does he live?
Just above here on Orange Tree Lane.
Oh, why bless you for a stranger. No such place in this neighborhood.
But that can't be possible. The street's gone. Orange Lane is not the head of Hanover Street near Bamerton's Hill.
There is no such lane now.
You cannot be serious. Woman, you mock me. The next thing you will tell me is that there is no King George. However, be that as it may, you must see, madam, that both my daughter and myself are wet and weary. I must find a resting place. Can you direct me to Boston?
But this is Boston. The only city of Boston I know.
But not the one I know. Yes, Lightfoot, coming. Coming. I am wrong, of course. I don't know how I could have mistaken it, but this is a much finer city than Boston. And Boston must lie at a distance, my good woman, since you are ignorant of it. Yes. It's the same old story. No home tonight. I must away.
No! Mr. Rugg, wait! Wait!
Who are you, sir?
Oh, a thousand pardons, Mistress Croft. May I present myself? Judge Jonathan Dunwell of the Circuit Courts, but recently come to Boston.
A judge?
Had you some business with that man?
Not legal business, but I had hoped to meet him here and question him. I am obsessed with a desire to know exactly who and what he is.
I'm ashamed for allowing you to stand so long in the rain. Come in and warm yourself by my fire. May I offer you some more sherry, Your Worship?
No, no. You are more than kind to have given me what I have against the chill. Heaven help that poor man in an open carriage.
And that child beside him.
And the child.
That a man named Rugg once owned this house is all I know. The factor who arranged for my father to take it over is supposed to have made sure all papers are legal.
How I wish I could have stopped him, learned more about him, tried to solve the mystery of him.
The mystery of him? Well, I cannot help there, but I should think the factor who sold us this house should know more of him than anyone, if he is still alive.
Could you give me his name and address? I shall not rest till I have followed this strange affair to its depths and its beginnings.
You understand the hour is late, Judge.
Yes, I do indeed, Mr. Felt. You know the history of Peter Rugg, sometime of Middle Street in this district?
I will be brief. He rented a property of mine in his youth. He was married to a fine young woman who bore him a daughter, as I remember.
Jenny.
So I believe was the name. But no matter, an offspring. And then without so much as a by your leave, he ran off with the child, leaving the wife to die, as I believe or remember. Yes. She died.
Why?
Well, damn it, she was deserted. Fortunately, Rugg left no creditors. He owned his horse and chaise, and after she died, it was all soon forgotten. Soon forgotten. I suppose he died.
No. To the best of my belief, he is now alive and living. I have lately seen him and his horse and chaise, and his child.
Oh, is that so? That's so. Well, now, I wouldn't presume to argue with a man of your standing that Peter Rugg could still be alive. I will not deny, but Jenny Rugg, if you saw her, let's see now, the Boston Massacre was 1770, was it not?
I fortunately avoided it, but history records that date.
So, on that date, Jenny was 10 years of age, and if living, that would make her, let's see, 60 now, give or take a year.
Do you know what you're saying?
Well, if Peter Rugg is still alive, which I take is possible, he could be only 10 years older than myself. And I was only 80 last March.
It was obvious that Mr. Felt was in his dotage. So, despairing of gaining any further intelligence from him, I returned to my lodgings at the Marlborough Hotel. If Peter Rugg, I thought to myself, has been traveling since the Boston Massacre, there is no reason I can see now that he shouldn't travel to the end of time. And I might have left it there had I not descended to the tap room for a nightcap and there encountered Mr. Derwin.
I ran up against a man whose grandfather knew our elusive friend, Mr. Rugg, and can now tell you the whole story, such as it is.
Then by all means begin.
It seems that, if my informant is worthy of credit, Peter Rugg, a man in comfortable circumstances, with one daughter and a wife, lived in Boston on Middle Street. He was a man generally esteemed, save for one thing.
Well, don't keep me on tenterhooks. What?
An ungovernable temper. So violent that the wig would rise from his head. And while his fits were upon him, he had no respect for heaven or earth.
A sorry spectacle. Some of it hard to believe.
Less hard to believe than his punishment for it.
Well, what does that mean, sir?
Well, whilst visiting in Concord one day late in autumn, with his daughter in the chaise, drawn by his favorite horse, a great black beast named Lightfoot, a tremendous storm overtook them, driving them for shelter, as dark fell, under the roof of a friend of his, a Mr. Cutter, who urged him to tarry the night.
Which any man in his right senses under the circumstances would do. And he did not heed his pleas?
Far from it, Judge. Instead,
the veins standing out on his neck and at his temples. He screamed to high heaven,
"Let the storm increase! Let God and the devil wreck their worst! I will see home tonight, or never see it more!"
And with that, he clapped whip to his horse and disappeared into the raging night.
Never to return home?
Never.
Incredible.
Eh, wasn't that supernatural?
Why?
The man is accursed. Whether by God or by the devil, I know not which.
Still 50 years of wandering in search of his home. How could it be possible?
Well, now, as to that, there are two theories. One I had from my informant. His grandfather said that on the day after he left Concord, 50 years ago, his friends and neighbors started inquiries. But it appeared that Peter Rugg had stayed no place in Boston. And his wife had a strange tale.
What tale is that?
Sitting by the window, waiting on that wild night, there was a sudden sound like an earthquake. And indeed, the whole house rumbled underneath her as if about to cave in. Peering out through the storm, she saw a strange sight.
What sight was that?
Coming hell for leather down the street was Peter Rugg in his carriage, straining back on the reins in a vain effort to stop his horse and crying,
"No, I put no! May you be damned for the devil you are! Hold up, I say! We are who?
So that fiery horse of his had the bit between his teeth and would not stop?
Yes. But there were those who discount the story, saying merely that Peter Rugg wanted to leave his wife and never come home at all. That there was another woman somewhere.
That scarcely fits the facts as we know them.
Well, then, there is the other theory.
Which is?
Perhaps best told by the woman who had the experience. Now, she's the wife of the toll gatherer on the Charlestown Bridge. Would you care to hear her tale for yourself?
Well, sirs, it's many years ago by now. My old man has gone to his rest. Lord save him, who could bear me out. In those days, we were both young and spry, and many the evening I used to keep him company here at the toll gate.
Those days were when?
Oh, nigh under 50 years ago.
Well, I'm sorry to have interrupted. Go on with your story.
But I remembered how annoyed Ethan was by this big black horse and the chaise and the man and the little girl. Used to tell me how they continually were in contempt of the rates crossing the bridge without stopping or paying.
And were they always followed by bad weather?
Why, bless you, sir, that is the truth. My Ian used to say they brought bad luck.
And you say you saw them?
One evening we heard them thundering up, and I says, "This time they ain't going to take it out on you, Ethan. You're too easy going." So when he called them to halt and they kept on, I had grabbed up a three-legged stool. Heavy it was, but I was young and strong, and I hurled it square into the horse's belly.
And tell the judge what happened then.
It passed right through that horse as if it were a shatter. He never even broke stride as a stool went skipping across the bridge. No, sir, that was a haunt. A ghost rider with bad luck riding the dust of his wheels.
So, Judge Dunwell, what is your judgment?
I don't know. Neither explanation fits the pattern of my mind. And I have a feeling that I am not yet done with Peter Rugg. Nor will be till his fate is truly revealed to me.
And the judge's instinct was right. Neither he nor we are yet done with the haunting tale of Peter Rugg, the man or ghost who wanders so hopelessly in search of home and rest. I'll return shortly with Act 3.
It's me, Helen Hayes, and now it's Trick or Treat, but with a slightly different twist. I'm putting aside all the many masks of character an actress must wear in her career and appearing here before you as Helen Hayes, person of the world, asking you to think briefly of the millions of children all over the world who know little or nothing of Halloween and its wood smoke and witches, of ghoulies and ghosties and things that go bump in the night. Kids who know only the grim realities and the unwelcome specters of disease and hunger and malnutrition, ignorance. These are the children I ask you to help treat with your help and assistance to UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, to help feed, cure, and educate the children of the developing countries only jet hours away from our very doorstep. I know you want to help, so write UNICEF, United Nations, New York, 10017. Thank you.
Me.
I went to the zoo once with him.
He tickles me a little.
It's because it's long, wide, and it's fun to go with you, Dad.
A little rich. We had fun and we played some games.
When he lied down on the rug, I'd hop on him and I'd punch him. Then he'd be silly to me.
We went to the park and we ate some french fries and some hamburger.
He does nice things and stuff.
He's a tickle monster sometimes.
It takes so little of you to give so much to them. Give your children everything. Give them your time.
He should love you and hug you forever.
A thought from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons.
To be 5 years before Peter Ruggs and Judge Dunwell's paths crossed again. For some time, the judge had tried to track down the sometimes elusive person, or legend, whichever he was. Then, being only human, Peter Rugg had almost passed from his mind until the rest of the judge's story, which you are about to hear now.
In the autumn of 1825, I attended the races at Richmond in Virginia. There was great excitement and the races were well attended, for it was a match race between two recognized champions, a roan called Dart and a light gray mare called Butterfly. At a signal, the gun sounded, and they were off. I was glued to the race. There seemed no way of choosing which horse might win, when suddenly there was an extra wave of excitement from the already madly cheering crowd. To my open-mouthed astonishment, appearing as if from nowhere in the rear, was a majestic black horse of unusual size, drawing an old weather-beaten chair. Effortlessly, as if his heavy non-racing vehicle, encumbered as it was by two occupants, didn't exist, he overtook the racing horses shortly before the winning line. And in concert, both Dart and Butterfly, as the horse passed them, lay back their ears and pulled up short, so that no contest was called. And the winning black horse and his carriage passed the finish line and faded away over the hill. In the clubhouse later, I was fortunate enough to have an introduction to one John Spring, the owner and rider of Butterfly.
Damn it, sir, that was no horse that overtook my mare. No one can outrun Butterfly. No horse, that is. Why, I had bet all I have she would show her heels to Dart.
No doubt she would if the...
Good horse, make no mistake. Good horse is Dart, a great one. But not outrun my Butterfly. That ox or whatever animal it was and frighten off our horses, why, that makes no contest, sir. No contest.
And yet it looked like a horse.
In no fashion, sir. Nor was it. In no fashion. And that I can prove.
How is that, Mr. Spring?
By my own observation and countless others, sir. Would you like to see?
I would indeed.
Well, then, follow me. Now, you remember... Just about here, both of them pulled up and let that interloper go by and disappear.
Yes, the view is unfamiliar from this point, but I do remember it was shortly before the finish line.
Exactly, sir. Both horses, after pulling up, walked deliberately to this spot of soft ground.
butterfly dropped her head and then lifted it, whickering and fried. And Dot followed by doing the same and snorting in a sort of anger. So all of us looked to what they had examined. See you then there for yourself, Judge.
I was looking at the hoof marks of the black horse which had carried on to the finish line and beyond. Horse? From the evidence of my eyes from the stands, yes. From the same evidence as I looked at the soft ground, Mr. Spring's strange claim had real validity. These were not the marks of a horse's hooves, but the evidence of another breed of animal or being. The hooves were cloven.
Judge Dunwell.
Mr. Derwin, your business takes you far afield.
In the nature of things. Not like what happened today at the races.
You saw?
Oh, yes.
I was stunned, weren't you? I thought Peter Rugg had vanished.
Oh, no, not I, sir. In the years since we met, I have come across him time and again. And gotten soaked to the skin because of him. In New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and the last time, but shortly, in Delaware.
Have you spoken?
The last time only.
Tell me, if you will, what took place.
Well, sir, on his brooch, he checked his horse with some difficulty. A more beautiful horse I'd never seen.
Sir, your face seems familiar. Perhaps I may engage your help. If you are, as may be, traveling to Boston, I should be glad to accompany you, for I have lost my way. My little girl here is weary, and I must reach home tonight.
Ah, that would be impossible, sir. For you are in Concord, in the county of Sussex, which is in the state of Delaware.
But Concord? That is only 20 miles from Boston, and my horse Lightfoot could carry me to the Charlestown Ferry in less than 2 hours. You mistake, sir. You are a stranger here. I am well acquainted with Concord, and this town is nothing like it.
Because this is Concord in the state of Delaware.
Huh? What do you mean by state?
Why, one of the United States, man.
States? Do you mock me? Because my heritage is Dutch? I know well I am not in Holland. As a gentleman, I beg you not to mislead me. Tell me, quickly, for pity's sake, before my horse swallows its bit. He is so starved. Set me on the right road for Boston.
If I could, and I did, it would be 500 miles from here.
500 miles, you say? Nay, I will listen no more. This beats the Connecticut River. Get up, Lightfoot! Get up!
I can explain his last mark. I met him, as you may remember, outside Hartford, when he persisted in mistaking the Connecticut River for the Charles.
So a wandering homeseeker is still abroad. Man or spirit, I shall not rest until he can. But how to help him? The courts were closed until the winter session. It seemed to me that the judgment on Peter Rugg was too great, too inhumane, too unreasonable for the extent of his small crime. I made it my business wholly for once to try to catch him again. But I always seemed fated to be just too late. At the toll gate on the turnpike between Alexandria and Middleburg, he had passed and paid no toll. But the toll gatherer was grateful, for he brought rain behind him to relieve a drought. Back in Virginia at the toll bridge, an irate gatekeeper told me that, annoyed by the number of times Rugg had passed that way refusing to pay, he had stood in the way of the vehicle, and it had passed right through him, or over him, without so much as touching him. On the ferry boat across the Hudson, a Mr. Hardy, who collected fares, showed me a fare that a man had given him, insisting it was 30 shillings. It might have been once. It was a half crown, coined by the British Parliament, dated 1649. Then I knew I had caught up with Peter Rugg again at last. I found him in his rig at the bow of the boat. Greetings, Mr. Rugg.
Huh? Oh, yes. You seem familiar, sir.
Judge Dunwell, we have met on the road before.
Yeah, that could be possible, sir. May I say that since you are a stranger here, my house is your home.
Dame Rugg will be happy to see her husband's friend. Step into my chair, sir, if you will. Move over, Jenny, for the great man. We shall be in Middle Street very shortly.
For many reasons, I will take advantage of your kind invitation. I sneaked a glance at my companions. Both were dressed in incredibly old-fashioned garments of fine cloth, but showing great wear. Rugg himself, at least in the face, was little more than skin drawn over the skull and cheekbones. Jenny was so bundled up, she suggested only to my sad and horrified eye what her wizened, dried-out face proclaimed. A small Egyptian mummy. Only Lightfoot looked bigger, sleeker, and more magnificent than ever.
This is not Boston, sir.
Then, mayhap it is New York.
How can it be New York, sir, when that place is 200 and more miles from Boston? But I thought I was home.
Mr. Rudd, look to the west. Only the size of a blackberry now, but that looks like an angry storm on our trail.
Ah! It is in vain to escape. I know that cloud. It brings new wrath to spend on my head. Go now, kind stranger, whoever you are. Leave me to my fate.
No, not this time, Peter Rugg. Give me the reins. This time, perhaps, we can outrun the storm. I took them from his slack hands, sliding over him and pushing him back to huddle with his daughter. And it needed only one flick to send that strange horse on his way like the wind. As we careened around the first corner, I noticed that his front hooves had been split on some hard road somewhere, but were healing. So Mr. Spring had been at least half right about the cloven hooves. I remembered little of that nightmare ride for Boston. How many days passed, where we stayed, or ate or slept. I only know that no matter how fast we traveled, that mushrooming black cloud stayed on our heels every step of the way. And then at last, we were in Boston, on Middle Street. A crowd was gathered. The great elm still stood, although barren now of leaves, fire blackened. And all that remained of the house was a heap of rubble, all else burnt to the ground, as I knew it to be, for the fire had taken place 2 years before.
I tell you, men of the North End, this is holy ground. The city needs this land, and let not the name of Peter Rugg dampen your ardor.
No! I hold rent entitled to this place.
No, hush, Mr. Rugg. Listen for a moment longer.
But no man tried to tell you that Peter Rugg is long since dead and gone to his reward or punishment. Let not legislators shake the right entitled to this land, which is free and clear.
But how can this be? Who has burned my house to the ground? And who are all these strange people? I thought I knew every man in Boston, but I do not recollect at this moment that I ever saw one of these. Who are these strangers?
Listen to me, Peter Rugg. The only stranger here is you. You have suffered many years under an illusion. Look behind. The cloud, the storm. Your nemesis is gathering.
Then I must flee. Away from home again.
Oh, if you do, you have no home.
If I stay, there is none left.
Don't you see that for over 50 years, the tempest which you so profanely defied at Monotomy has driven you before it like a straw in the wind? And now it is too late. Your wife, your house, and all your neighbors have disappeared. You have no home left here. You have been cut off from one age, and you can never be fitted to the present. You can never have another home again in this world, you or your daughter, unless...
Yes. Quickly, for the storm is almost upon us. Unless what?
Unless you stop fleeing it. Let it catch up with you and perhaps pass you by. Then, mayhap, at long last, you can find rest.
Oh, rest. Sweet, blessed rest. Oh, my father, forgive me. And take me and Jenny home.
The great black clouds and teeming rain engulfed us all. My last view of Peter Rugg was standing with his arm about his daughter, his face lifted to the rain. And wonder of wonders, at last the child's head, too, was lifted. In the intensity of it, they were lost. And suddenly the storm passed. For a moment, in its last fringe, I saw the two of them, eyes on heaven. And then, as if they had never been, chaise, horse, harness, father and daughter were gone. Where? I do not know. I can only hope home at last.
Judge Dunwell lived out a long and fruitful life, dying quietly in his bed one night. We do not know what his last thoughts were, but certainly one of them must have been that in all the last 40 years of his life, he never again met or heard of Peter Rugg. I shall be back shortly.
Mrs. Beverly Sills, did you know that of all the arts, music is the only one in which a blind person can participate freely in spite of blindness? However, even in music, the blind needs special help in order to stand on an equal footing with the sighted. The Lewis Braille Foundation for Blind Musicians works to promote the interests of the blind in the field of music. The foundation, a national nonprofit organization, urgently needs your financial help. The services of the Lewis Braille Foundation are available to any blind person and provide auditions, evaluations and counseling, scholarship aid, paid engagements for qualified musicians, and transcription of music into Braille. The foundation depends solely on the public for its support. Send your tax-deductible gifts to the Lewis Braille Foundation, 112 East 19th Street, New York, 10003. If you know a musically gifted blind person who needs help, please contact the Lewis Braille Foundation at area code 212-982-7290.
There is no one more tragic in all history or literature than the soul condemned to wander, lost, alone, cut off. And I do have to wonder a little if Peter Rugg didn't make his own penance. What we fear in life, we should not run from, especially if we can't outdistance it. Turn and meet it face to face. It's surprising that the reality is never as bad as the imagined. Our cast included Michael Tolan, Fred Gwynn, Ann Petoniak, Arnold Moss, and Ian Martin. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown. And now, a preview of our next tale.
You don't hear it?
It is, I think so.
Well, is it your imagination, too?
No.
What? What is it?
It's a ghost. Now, Abigail.
I know there's no such thing as a ghost, but what do you call that?
Well,
John, I remember my grandfather and my aunt. They'd tell us children stories about... John, I'm frightened.
Oh, dear Abigail, it's impossible.
Big, gloomy, frightening house. Who knows what crimes may have been committed here?
Abigail, there's no
such thing as a ghost. Then why is your hand shaking?
Radio Mystery Theater was sponsored in part by Buick Motor Division and Anheuser-Busch Incorporated, brewers of Budweiser. This is E.G. Marshall inviting you to return to our Mystery Theater for another adventure in the macabre. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
This is KOIN Portland. The time is 12 midnight.
PBS News. Egypt's President Sadat flies to New York today to address the UN General Assembly. I'm Ann Krosman reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Tight security will be in effect for Sadat's visit, more than 1,000 policemen on duty. New York's Mayor Abraham Beame has refused to give an official welcome to the Egyptian leader, saying it would be hypocritical in light of Egypt's support of a UN resolution calling Zionism a form of racism. Sadat hosted a dinner for President and Mrs. Ford last night in Washington, and Bernard Kalb has a report.
The newly discovered diplomatic camaraderie of the United States and Egypt was underscored at a dinner hosted by President Sadat. He applauded President Ford for his efforts to bring about peace in the Middle East. President Ford, in turn, applauding President Sadat for his statesmanship in the search for peace. There was one embarrassing slip during the exchange of toasts at the very end when President Ford lifted his glass in a toast to Sadat and to the great people of the government of Israel. Mr. Ford quickly added, "Excuse me, of Egypt." The toast came as a finale to a busy diplomatic day for President Sadat, who discussed economic and military aid with President Ford at the White House, and who said he urged President Ford to begin a U.S. dialogue with a Palestine Liberation Organization. Israel has vowed never to negotiate with the PLO, while Washington has said it first must accept Israel's existence. Bernard Kalb, CBS News, Washington.
The latest from Beirut in a minute.
When the leaves come off, put the collar on. The two-in-one collar from Hearts.
Your dog can get ticks anytime, so keep a Hearts two-in-one collar on year-round. For every tick it kills now, up to 2,000 ticks won't be born this spring. To really kill ticks and fleas, the Hearts two-in-one collar is always in season.
When the leaves come off, put the collar on. The two-in-one collar from Hearts.
I'm a bartender. Now, I just put a guy in a cab because he was too drunk to drive. Why me, when his best friend's right here? Drive your friend home, I said. He said, come on, a few beers, coffee will straighten him out. Well, I straightened him out. Too much beer or wine can get you just as drunk as most mixed drinks, and coffee won't sober you up. Next time his buddy gets a lowdown, we'll see how good a friend he is.
Friends don't let friends drive drunk. A public service message on behalf of the U.S. Department of Transportation.
There was more fighting reported today in almost all quarters of Beirut between predominantly Muslim and Christian factions. Beirut Radio said a huge complex of shops and offices was set on fire for the second time in about a month. Premier Rashid Karami is waiting for the rest of his National Security Committee to assemble. Five of the nine members have gathered in his office, but three of the most important factional leaders have not said if they will take part in the latest effort to end the violence. American Embassy employees are being evacuated from Beirut, and Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, the fifth largest American bank, says it is moving its Mideast office from Beirut to Amman, Jordan. President Ford plans to propose an overhaul of bankruptcy laws today so that if New York City defaults, essential services will keep operating. Mr. Ford has reported ready to restate his position that the federal government has no business bailing New York City out of its money problems. The state of Massachusetts is having its financial headaches. Kevin Harrington, president of the state Senate, says Massachusetts is going to run out of money by next April, and he just does not have the votes in the Senate to increase taxes. Harrington had some gloomy predictions about what would happen under default.
That means the prison guards will not be paid. Maybe they'll work without pay. Let's hope so, if that happens. The attendants in the mental hospitals will not be paid. Welfare recipients will not receive money because the federal government will not match if we can't put up our 50%. Public higher education with 100,000 students will close. There will be no plows to plow the highway because the highway employees will not be paid, etc., etc., etc.
Kevin Harrington, president of the Massachusetts State Senate. More news coming up.
This CBS News correspondent is the first woman to be named a vice presidential correspondent.
Arriving at Washington's National Airport, Rockefeller called David Bellin, the man selected as the executive...
She's Connie Chung, CBS News, Washington, and her current assignment is Vice President Rockefeller. Connie joined us in 1971, and her first assignment was to cover the Capitol Hill hearings on the danger of phosphates in detergents. One assignment she won't forget, says Connie, was camping outside H.R. Haldeman's home early every morning, hoping for a statement during the Watergate hearings. Connie was also deeply involved in covering the House impeachment deliberations last summer. She's a native of Washington, D.C., and graduated from the University of Maryland with a major in journalism and a minor in broadcasting. Before joining CBS News, Connie worked for a Washington television station and received the 1971 Outstanding Young Woman of America Award. Connie Chung, reporting for CBS News on the CBS Radio Network.
The Israeli military command said today that Israeli soldiers killed two Arab guerrillas yesterday and captured five others in a brief gunfight on the Israeli-Syrian front. No Israeli casualties were reported. Spain's Generalissimo Franco was reported slightly improved today after doctors had said his condition was extremely grave. His internal bleeding is under control and his heartbeat is regular. I'm Ann Crosman, CBS News.
It's 6 minutes after 12 on a Wednesday morning. My name's Bill Garrity. I'll take a look at local news at 12:30. Good morning.